At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome to What's Eric Eating? Culture Map's bi-weekly look at all things Houston bars and restaurants. I'm your host, Culture Map editor Eric Sandler. Today on the show, I'll have a conversation with someone in the food world I think you'll want to hear from. He is a chef and partner in Mayahuel, a new restaurant in Autry Park. Chef Luis Robledo, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hi, Eric. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm doing great. I'm very excited about Mayahuel.
Yes. Well, thank you for doing this. I want to talk about that, but I also want to start at the beginning of your career because you've really had quite a career. So just tell me a little bit about how you got started. How did you become interested in being a professional chef?
Then I have to go back to 1996. I was fresh out of college. And I majored in business and economics, which not many people know, but I did. But I never liked it. So I was in, you know, I was always in pursuit of something different. So life took me to New York City. I was working, you know, at the time I was working in Mexico City. I was very young, so I was working in bars and restaurants, but only for, you know, I would say for the atmosphere and the party. More than the passion.
Right. A little spending money and a good time.
Exactly. But then, you know, life took me to New York City and I started working for restaurant Daniel Boulud. At the time, this was 98. At the time, he only had that one restaurant Daniel. And very shortly after that, he opened Cafe Boulud. So I was there in a time where I think New York City was very exciting. The food scene was growing immensely. Everything was, of course, you know, very new to me. I was very, you know, young and very impressionable. So I just fell in love with everything they were doing. I mean, to me, everything was new techniques. Just the opulence of the restaurant was unbelievable. And the way they worked, I just fell in love with it. And then after that, my career continued at Daniel for another 3 years, 2.5 years. And then I decided to go to Paris. I worked in Paris for another 2 years. I worked at Le Pré Catelan, which is now a 3-Michelin-star establishment. It was led, and it's still being led by Frédéric Anton, which is an amazing chef, very famous in France now. And then while I was in Paris, I started taking culinary classes at Le Nôtre, which is also a very famous school in Paris. So I enrolled in some of the more pastry and chocolate specific classes. Because, you know, prior to that, I was only doing cooking. So like the previous years were like 2, 3, 4 years before that, I was doing only cooking. But then the 2, 3 years subsequent to that, I was more focused on in pastry and chocolate.
All right. So what drove your interest in pastry? Because usually savory chefs, most chefs are one or the other, right? It's unusual to find a chef who would be interested in both.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm very curious. I love everything about hospitality. And that's something that I learned working, I think, for Daniel and some other restaurants. So I was always interested in, you know, cooking, savory food, pastry, bread, chocolate, wine, coffee. I love everything. I mean, I just fell in love with the whole industry. So I think from a very early point in my career, I decided that I wanted to learn as much as I could in every single aspect of hospitality.
So you started in New York, you went to Paris.
Yeah.
Where did you go after Paris?
I came back to New York.
Back to Daniel or to work for someone else?
So when I was working at Daniel, he's been a very, very well-known chef even back then. And Daniel used to be chef at Le Cirque before going solo. Before he opened Daniel restaurant, he was chef at Le Cirque. So, you know, you make your connections and you know your people. So when I was in Paris, I briefly went back to Mexico City to help open a French brasserie called Au Pied de Cochon, which is still runs as a very successful business in Mexico. And during that opening, I was told that restaurant Le Cirque was looking for a pastry chef. Of course, you know, being in New York, cooking savory, then going to Paris and still doing savory. But at the same time, I was learning pastry, then went to Mexico and I was cooking savory. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to apply for this job. I don't have any prior pastry experience, but I think I have enough knowledge of the kitchen and I have enough knowledge of pastry techniques. And I think I have enough ideas to at least apply. So I did. I applied. I met with Le Cirque's general manager. His name is Benito Sevarin. Amazing hospitality guy, extremely knowledgeable, extremely professional. So I met with him and he said, you know what? Our pastry chef just quit and he is opening a chocolate business. His name is Jack Torres. I'm like, okay, Jack is an MOF. He was such a personality in New York. So in my mind, I didn't have anything to lose, you know, trying to replace a legend. So I think, you know, I actually thought I was dumb enough to take the job or they were dumb enough to take me. So,
yeah, untested to their very prominent, very famous French restaurant. But I mean, you'd been in Paris, like you know how to make an eclair or a profiterole or whatever. Like you were qualified.
Yeah, I was qualified. I don't think I was qualified enough to run such a big kitchen. And I'll tell you why in a second. So they flew me to New York and I stayed at the restaurant for 3 days. They made me do a tasting, which went really well. I pretty much stuck to the basics and things that I knew worked. And after that week, they hired me. And I think it was one of those situations where I was very good making the food, but I was not ready to run a kitchen as complex as that. Because back then, the Cirque's owner, Cirio Maccioni, he loved pastries. He loved the pastry program. And I remember him sending desserts to almost every single table in the restaurant. Even if they didn't order dessert, he would just send out pastries, desserts, creme brulees, petit fours. So when I got to Le Cirque in 2001, and the restaurant was running a huge payroll, they had like, you know, 25, 26 people in the kitchen, like the savory kitchen. And my team in pastry was 16 people. So
I'm sorry, did you say 16?
16, 1-6. Yeah.
That's bonkers.
It's wild.
I mean, kitchen crew at Mayaquil is probably 16.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, not even.
I mean, I guess what you're saying is that you could make the individual recipes fine. Like you had the technical knowledge, but the organizational knowledge of administering a staff of that size and keeping up with the pace of production, that's where you came up a little short, it sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, all the forecasting and all the planning for the you know, the week and the subsequent, you know, months, for me was very challenging managing, people that, you know, most of them were, older than I was. There is one, individual that I want to mention. His name is Francisco Gutierrez, Mexican guy. At the time, he'd been at Le Cirque for almost 20 years. And, you know, here comes the young pastry chef trying to run the kitchen. And I mean, he could have, you know, just said, you know, like, shut up, kid. I'm not listening to you. I've been running this kitchen myself for 20 years. But it was exactly the opposite. He was extremely welcoming. He was very professional, extremely professional. So every time that he saw that I was going to make a mistake, or that I was about to do something stupid, he would make a suggestion like, hey, chef, wouldn't it be better if you did this or did that? So he was extremely gracious to me. So he basically took me under his wing and he helped me run that kitchen for 3.5 years.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you had a, so you had a lengthy run at Le Cirque. And then when did you go back to Mexico City?
So after that, after Le Cirque, I went to the Four Seasons Hotel in New York, also as their executive pastry chef. At the time, New York City was booming again, you know, post 9/11. Michelin got to the city. Alain Ducasse opened his restaurant in New York. Thomas Keller opened Per Se. So it was a big time for New York City. And then Joël Robuchon opened his restaurant at the Four Seasons, L'Atelier de Joël Robuchon, which is also very successful. So that was also a very exciting time for me. I kept, you know, doing my pastry stuff. I was also doing savory. I was helping and co-managing the hotel with the executive chef. My title went from pastry chef to executive pastry chef to co-executive chef. So it was very exciting. It was amazing.
And just to sort of fix this in the time, this is what, like 2006 or seven, I guess?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. After that, you know, my wife and I decided that we had to leave the city because, you know, we wanted to have a baby together. And she was trying to get pregnant, and it was a challenge for her to do that, you know, the stressful life of New York. So we said, okay, we need to go to a place where we can live a quieter life. So we moved to Mexico. And that's when my chocolate shop took off. I decided to open a chocolate shop in Mexico just because I love pastries and chocolate. That's something that I still do. I love it. And that business is still, you know, running, and, you know, it works really well. It's an amazing business. And during that time, a lot of things changed. My first daughter was born. Then my second daughter was born 2 years after that, a year and a half after that. And then, you know, we kept doing the chocolate business for a few years. You know, we opened several shops. And it went from just selling chocolate bars, chocolate bonbons, to selling pastries, and then, you know, cafeteria style food, specialty coffee, and then chocolate drinks. And it was just an evolution for the next 6 years. It was.
Right. And this is Tu Chocolat, right? This is exactly.
That's the one. That's the name. That's Tu Chocolat.
Right. And just for the audience, right? This is really what established your professional reputation, right? You kind of came back to Mexico with this pedigree of having worked for Danielle and at the Four Seasons, and you opened this chocolate shop. And I mean, I know you're not going to toot your own horn, but I'll toot it lightly for you. There was nothing like this in Mexico City at the time that you opened that chocolate shop.
I think there was nothing like that, not only in Mexico, but like in anywhere in the, like the Northern Hemisphere, like, you know, US, Canada. There was very little at the time, you know. It was mostly, let's say, rustic chocolate shops. There was nothing really specialized in high-end chocolate. And I took a chance, you know, I gambled with the concept. It was misunderstood from the beginning. It took us around 2 years to really establish the business. But I mean, once it did, I mean, now it's been running for, you know, over almost 20 years. So,
right. And just for people, when you say, you know, there's kind of rustic chocolate shops and then there's more, and then there's what you were doing, what were you doing that made that stood out, that was distinct?
So I think it's mostly, you can compare this to, probably the best analogy would be specialty coffee, maybe wine, where producers really specialized in making quality a top priority. Because if you make the analogy with coffee, you know, you go from the industrial brands, you know, making coffee for you to brew at home, not paying any attention to origin, or how the coffee was roasted. They were not following any like roasting profiles. And then they went from that to looking at where the coffee was coming from, how the coffee was harvested, selected, processed, you know, roasted, and then how it ended up in a cup. the wine had the same evolution, and then chocolate did the same thing. Back in the early 2000s, I saw, and I think, I kind of pioneered that same movement, which is selecting the cacao beans from the best sources that I could find, and then transforming that into chocolate and then into confections. And that was the birth of the bean to bar movement. There was a big, big movement in the States. I mean, I think the US is still the biggest bean to bar movement in the world. It's amazing. And I think I was doing that in Mexico before anyone else. Of course, there's a lot of, I'm not going to claim anything. I'm just saying that, to my understanding, I was one of the first. But not only one of the first. I think I was one of the first to take it to a very refined stage of not only making traceable, delicious chocolate, but also market it and finish it in beautiful packaging. It was very elegant, still very elegant, paying attention to every detail from the decorations. The machinery that I was using or that I'm using is very technologically advanced. Production methods, we pay attention to every single part of the process. So I think that's what separates the more, rustic or old-fashioned chocolate shops to the modern high-end chocolate businesses.
And then eventually, the world's 50 best named you the best pastry chef in Latin America. That must have been a really nice moment in your career.
Yeah, but remember that 50 best has a panel of voters that's like you. So 50 best has only, I think they have a great reputation. It was an amazing achievement for me because it's your colleagues selecting you as, in this case, the best pastry chef. However, in my mind, that award was given to me back in 2019. But I've never been a person who sits on awards or achievements. I'm always looking for the next project. So every time that someone mentions, 50 Best Awards or the World Chocolate Masters Awards and all the pastry and chocolate recognitions that I got, I usually say okay, yeah, but that was back in 2019, 2020, 2021, because after that, I did a lot of things that to me right now are a lot more important. So, but yeah, I mean, it was great. It was great. 50 Best was great. It was a lot of fun, actually.
All right. Well, let me fast forward just a little bit. Mm-hmm. How did you become interested in coming to Houston?
So in 2021, or maybe 2020, when the pandemic started, I met Arnaldo Richards from Picos, which I hadn't met before. And I mean, it was just funny because we started, talking through social media. He got my number through family members because it turns out that we're family. I mean, we're related, right?
Yeah, you're sort of cousins, right?
Yeah, he's technically
it's not super close, but you have family members in common.
Exactly. He's my uncle. So we started talking and then he invited me to Houston to, come visit, and he wanted me to see what he was doing at Picos. So I came to Houston for the first time around, I think it was 2020. It was right in the beginning of the pandemic, actually. And so I remember Arnaldo telling me hey, man, you better watch out because we went together to the rodeo and there's all these people getting sick. So if you feel any symptoms, you should get checked. I was like, oh, my God, what was I doing in Houston? But anyway, so I went to the rodeo. It was the first time that I was in Houston and I just loved it. I just loved the vibe, the people. It was the first time for me looking at the barbecue competitions happening, at the rodeo, the flavors. And I spent, I think, 4 or 5 days with Arnaldo in Houston. And he took me around. I mean, he took me, I think we went together to Truth Barbecue. I think that was one of our first meals together. And I was very impressed. I loved it. We went to Pico's, went to a couple of Ben Berg's restaurants. I remember going to a Papa Steakhouse. And I was blown away with the steaks and the quality of the food. And I was just, it was very interesting to me because in the world of, high-end cooking and gastronomy, Houston is never mentioned. I mean, you hear about New York, LA, San Francisco. I don't know, maybe now Miami's in
Chicago
the map.
Always comes up.
Chicago,
usually.
Of course. And if you hear about a city in Texas that has great food, it was always, in my mind, it was always Austin.
Yes.
So when I came to Houston, I was like, oh my God, like this city is, incredibly underrated. And I still think that. Anyway, but
I've been personally trying to change that for 13 years, right? Just talking about how much great food we have in this town, but you know, and we've had moments where I feel like we've kind of broken through the national consciousness, but I agree. Still to this day, I don't know that we get the respect that we deserve.
Mm. And during those conversations and my trips to Houston with Arnaldo, we started talking about doing something here in Houston that was chocolate related. But then I started, during those years, I was consulting a lot. I was consulting for hotels, other restaurants. And this was more on the savory side, not the pastry side. So I created, with Arnaldo's help, and my team, because we had a great team at the time, a very creative team that I use and that worked with me in Mexico. And we do a lot of consulting. Still to this day, we do consulting. We created a couple of concepts. One of them was Mayanwell. And the other one that I think you know too is, or was, Comalito. So that was the first, or my first contact with Houston. It was through Arnaldo.
Yeah. And I want to dive into Mayanwell, but I also just briefly, I want to touch on Comalito, because I thought, as you said, I was familiar with it. I ate there quite a bit. I thought the idea of a casual taqueria that makes its own nixtamalized tortillas and has ties to Mexico City and has maybe the best churro I've ever had in my life was like an interesting idea that I thought would achieve some success, but obviously it didn't last very long. And we don't need to get into like all the nitty gritty of it, but what did you kind of learn from that experience as you like prepared to open Mayanwell?
So very briefly, I was introduced to the underbelly hospitality people by Arnaldo. And I think, at the time they were already probably in a transition phase because at the time Chris Shepherd had already left and they were trying to figure out a way to transition from that Chris Shepherd era to something new. So I think Comalito was something they were excited about. However, opening Comalito at the Houston Farmers Market was not, now that I see in retrospect, that was not the right decision. I think the location was not right for the brand. So after a few months of being opened, Underbelly had an offer from another establishment for that location. So they decided to go for the money and we shut down Comalito after a few months.
All right. So let's talk about Mayanwell because it's such a, Comalito was, casual. I mean, there were times when it had waiters, there were times when it was counter service, but it was a very approachable price point. It was kind of designed to be high volume. And Mayanwell is completely different. It's fine dining, it's elevated, it's more expensive, it's all of these things. So how did you decide that would be a better fit for you in terms of how you established yourself here in Houston?
Well, I think that's more my DNA. I think that's more my that's my foundation. Ever since my first job in New York City, I was always working in very elevated fine dining restaurants, Michelin star restaurants all over. Daniel Michelin stars, Le Pré Catelan Michelin stars, the Baltimore Hotel in Paris Michelin stars. So I was always involved in Michelin star establishments. Even after I started doing consulting, I always ended up doing something like that. Either people that wanted consulting because they were looking for Michelin stars or for 50 best recognition or something that was tied to or related to fine dining. So through Matt Reagan, who works at Rebies, Rebus is the company that curates, you know, all the food businesses and all the, I think it's all the businesses that go into Autry Park.
Right. They're a real estate kind of consulting leasing firm.
Exactly.
Just for the sake of the audience. I know Matt. Matt's great. I should have Matt on the show at some point. He'd have interesting things to say. And Rebus does Sugarland Town Square too, and Autry Park, and they're an interesting behind the scenes player. So you had a conversation with Matt. Take it from there.
So I met Matt Reagan almost by accident. But anyway, that's another story. I met Matt Reagan, and we started talking about an elevated Mexican restaurant at Autry Park. And during those, you know, conversations, I told him that I needed a local partner to do this with, because I was not going to risk, you know, failure by going into business by myself in a city that I pretty much didn't know. So after a few, you know, sessions and, you know, long conversations, he told me, you know what? I think I know someone that might be the perfect partner for you. And he introduced me to Omar Khan, who is the owner of Culinary Concepts, owners of Star Cinema Grill, Real Luxury Cinemas, you know, Liberty Kitchen, State Fair, The Audrey, Leo's. It's an amazing company. Great, 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 great structure. Real professionals. It was a good fit for me. I met Omar Khan in front of what today is Maya Well. And I talked to Omar Khan for over an hour. It was supposed to be just an introductory, you know, session, you know, talk about the concept, da, da, da. And we ended up talking for hours, literally. Just we understood each other very well from the beginning. So I gave him a beautifully crafted brand book with all the information about Maya Well, where the name came from, the style of food that I wanted to do, even some inspiration pictures for the core architecture, the open kitchen concept. Everything that I wanted to do was very clear from the beginning. And I mean, Omar being the visionary and the businessman that he is, he very quickly understood the vision. He loved it. And yeah, we shook hands, and the rest is history, I guess.
Talk about those ideas. Like, what are kind of the principles that govern Maya Well, and how do you kind of see it fitting in to Houston, where, you know, there are some other more upscale Mexican restaurants that are distinct from, you know, the Tex-Mex places that certainly I grew up with, right? If, you know, whether that's Hugo's or Cuchara or whatever, you know, you're coming into a city that at the very least, like, understands these flavors, even if they haven't had your version of them.
Yeah. So in terms of the concept, I was trying to find not only a name, but also like a figure that could, you know, very well represent what I wanted to do, which was have a great agave bar, which is not unique, I know that, but at least it was going to be my style of agave bar with unique cocktails, unique flavor combinations, using unusual ingredients, at least in cocktails in my mind. And then around that, having a great Mexican coffee program, a great culinary proposal, let's say that. That's going to be ever-changing, rotating, dishes being rotated and changed seasonally. And then finally, an amazing dessert program, something that separates this concept from others. So doing some research, I found this figure of Maya Well, which is the Aztec goddess of agave. I did some research, and I saw there's some other concepts already using the name in other parts of the world. But, you know, it's like there's some other, you know, businesses using the same name, representing the same things. But in the case of Maya Well, I was sure that I could do something that outclassed, outlived, and outpaced any other restaurant or any other bar that was using the same name in other places. because I just love the concept.
No, I think it's interesting to hear you describe it that way, because I've been thinking of it as a restaurant and you're focused on the bar program. And I hadn't, even though I've eaten there, I hadn't really thought about the bar program as being on an equal footing with the food offerings.
So let me talk about the bar program. So, as much as I love, food and everything that we discussed earlier about, me understanding pastry and coffee and food and pastries, all that thing. Chocolates, sorry. I love cocktails, but I'm not a heavy drinker. I've never been a heavy drinker. I've never been like super passionate about drinking cocktails, at least not regularly. Like, every now and then I do enjoy going out and having a great cocktail, but I'm not drinking constantly or regularly.
Right, right. Two or three in a night, that's kind of my limit.
But I do understand that having a successful restaurant that blows people's minds in terms of like the whole like 360 degree experience, where you get great food, great cocktails, great pastries, great coffee, like great everything. I knew and I understood that we needed a great cocktail program. So I've been friends with, his name is Osvaldo Vasquez. Osvaldo Vasquez is a very recognized, very well recognized bartender in Mexico. Super passionate guy. He's a cocktail nut. He understands everything about tequilas, mezcal. He has his own brands of, tequila, who's, very, very well respected. He was recently introduced to Texas, I think maybe a year ago. The name of the tequila is General Gorosieta. Additive-free tequila created by a master tequila maker. And he is just a cocktail, visionary. And I've been working with him in other projects. Like, I know him. I've known him for several years. And I always called him to help me with the cocktail program because he's just amazing. So it just made sense to me to bring him on board and asking him to create a cocktail menu that represented the Mayawell brand using the best ingredients that he could find in Houston, with great agave spirits and unique flavor combinations. So he spent 10 days with me back in March, and it was just a week of R&D, trying cocktails, trying different combinations, different presentations. Looking at glasses and cups and all these unique like blown glass designs and unique colors and all that. So we came up with the first iteration of Mayawell's cocktail menu, which was the one that was used for the opening menu, the opening week menu. But now he's coming back next week and he's going to help us tweak that menu and keep that offer really fresh, amazing, amazing character, amazing bartender. There's still people that go to Mayawell that were there during that first opening week that asked me about Osvaldo. When is he coming back? When are you having him back? We love the guy. He makes great cocktails. He made some off the menu, interesting recipes for us because we told them we liked, there was one that liked saffron. So Osvaldo came running in the kitchen and he's like, "Hey man, do you have any saffron?" I was like, "Yeah, I do. Why?" He's like, "Give me some. I need to make a cocktail." So he made a cocktail for some guest that just loved it. So I mean that's just the personality of the restaurant, bringing in people that are experts in what they do. Osvaldo is one of them. Also, there's a second Osvaldo. Osvaldo Vasquez is the bartender. Osvaldo Ortega is my chef de cuisine. He's been working with me for 16 years. Another expert in many, many areas. Like he knows moles, he knows culinary, he knows pastries. He's creating a pastry program for brunch at Mayawell. All the laminated doughs, croissants, pan au chocolat, conchas, cubiletes, garibaldis, like all the Mexican pastries. So it's a team effort. Like, I understand the big picture and I can execute it, but I'm also trying to surround myself with, talented people. And, another one of them, Kim Thompson, she's my sous chef. She used to work for Underbelly before, and she's now my senior sous chef at Maya Wow. So it's all about bringing in, you know, people that will make me better, people that will make the restaurant better, and will help me give our guests the best experience.
Yeah, and then let me just turn to the menu. What are a couple of the dishes that you've gotten the best response to, or that you're the most proud of, or that, you know, for people who are going to Maya Huel, like what are a couple of things that you think like you absolutely have to order on that first visit?
So I understood from the very beginning that we needed to be very careful about expectations when people go to Mexican restaurants, right? I'll give you an example. Your guacamole and chips. Like, that's the first thing that comes to your mind. Like, let's get some guac and chips while we think about the rest of the menu, right? This, like, you know, quick bites, appetizers that are very well known to Mexican restaurants. So the first dish that we created was, it's called avocado and chiquilpac. I mean, I've heard some people call it the Mexican hummus. I've heard, oh, you shouldn't call it like that. That's a disgrace, But the fact of the matter is that it's a very delicious sauce, you know, paste that's made in the south of Mexico using habaneros, tomatoes, pepitas, and other spices, onions.
It's also a very ancient dish, right? This is a dish that goes back to the Aztecs.
Yeah, it's Mayan, actually. It's Mayan. From the Mayas.
Thank you. Okay.
So we thought, you know, making a dish with this paste, chiquilpac, and avocados would make a very balanced dish. I mean, it's high in protein, high in fat, great fats, super flavorful, spicy enough to open your palate, but at the same time, light enough so you could, you know, have many, or at least, you know, a few more dishes after that. So I think that's one of the dishes that people order the most. Why? Because it's very easy to eat, very easy to understand, very simple flavors. You know, great ingredients. I think it's also a beautiful dish. And I think that fills the gap of people ordering guacamole and chips.
Right. You're not going to do chips and salsa. You're not going to do queso.
Exactly.
But you will do avocado and chiquilpac.
Yeah, that's one of them. And then, you know, we have been playing with tostadas. You know, we have a beautiful tuna tostada with uni. We served hamachi ceviche last week that we ran at the special that was extremely well received. And then, you know, we also have a section called tacos y masa, which I think is becoming very quickly the most popular section on the menu. And I mean, you talked about earlier of how we used to make nixtamal, comalito, and all that. Well, we took this to like the next level. We're still making nixtamal, but now we're doing a lot more, let's say, not intricate, but they're more, a little more complex version of your traditional street taco. I'll give you two examples. One is vegetarian, the other one's not vegetarian. The vegetarian version of the taco al pastor, instead of using pork, we use maitake mushrooms. And then we do a marinade with a mix of chiles, you know, like an adobo, like traditional al pastor, right? And then in Mexico, usually tacos al pastor are served with chopped onions, cilantro, and your choice of salsa. Some people like pineapple, some people don't like pineapple. So we said, okay, let's think about something that we could do to try to get all these ingredients together and come up with a version that people cannot say, oh, no onions, no cilantro, no salsa, no pineapple. So we created a mushroom cream, also using maitake mushrooms, but it's a mushroom cream that's made with onions, cilantro, a touch of vanilla, fresh vanilla beans from Mexico, of course. And that mushroom cream is spread onto the tortilla, and then we roast the maitake mushrooms and then put the maitake mushrooms on top. And then we finish with some pineapple, fresh pineapple, marinated in vanilla beans. So you have all the flavors of the taco al pastor together, just in a different order, in a different, you know, texture, different version. But I think that's one of the dishes that people like a lot. And then the other taco is called Mar y Tierra, you know, which is pretty much surf and turf.
Right. This was my favorite dish when I went to Maya Huel.
Yes, and it's also very popular with people now, with guests. We make beef cheek carnitas. So we cook the beef cheek in a mix of pork and dog fat, using all the aromatics that, you know, are used traditionally in carnitas in Mexico. And then we chop it, and then we make a taco, a cheese crust, and then we top it off with a shrimp, just a roasted shrimp. You know, we have a little Conro oven, you know, with charcoals, with Binchatan charcoals on top. And then we just lightly grill the shrimp, and it's served with some guacamole. I mean, not guacamole, sorry, some avocado, some pickled onions. Very simple dish, but it's, I think it's delicious.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously you know, you're open for dinner. You're doing brunch already. From your perspective, how's it going? Are people embracing the menu? Are they understanding what you're trying to achieve? Are they responding well?
Yeah. I mean, I would say 95% of people that I've talked to love the menu. It's a very, very, not very short. It's a short menu, easy to understand. And it's also a menu that will be changing, you know, mutating, evolving constantly. Of course, we will keep the staples, but also, as I said before, I'm a very curious guy and I like to explore options. So it's a menu that will be changing, you know, with how ingredients become available, depending on the season, depending on what's available, you know, now that the economy and ingredients are getting more and more expensive. That's also something that we take into consideration to keep the prices down, because we don't want to have a Mexican restaurant that's overpriced. So I think having that freshness of, you know, a rotating menu, even after 3 weeks of being open, we have made some changes, and that, you know, keeps people happy. So 90-95% of the guests that I've talked to are happy. But then, of course, there's also some people saying like, oh, this is not traditional Mexican, you know, in Mexico, you don't mix this with this. Or let's say during brunch, we've had some comments about the conchas, right? Like, oh, this is not a real concha, which, you know, I understand. But if I try to please everyone, and if I try to, I listen to every single critique I do, and I take it very seriously. But at the same time, I have a concept, and I have a vision in my mind that I want to accomplish. And I don't think I want to deviate from that. So for some people, you know, the conchas might not be the traditional conchas, because we're making a dough that's a lot richer in butter, more like a French brioche, let's say that. And then we top it up with the crispy crunchy crust, which is usually made with margarine or a substitute for butter, let's say that, to make it cheaper. And we do only butter. So the flavor does, you know, change from what you would find in Mexico. And then the same thing, you know, with our moles. We try to keep it as traditional as possible. But for example, our mole negro, we do not char the chiles as much as they do in Oaxaca, which is, that's what makes the mole become like black. I do enjoy some bitterness in the mole, the complexity of the mole, but I do like my version as well, you know. Some moles have 27, 28 ingredients. You know, the one that we make at Maya Well have over 30. So it's our version, our interpretation, our vision of Mexican cuisine. And we're doing our best to communicate that to whoever goes to Maya Well. And so far, honestly, we've had an amazing response. I'm super happy. I'm very, very thrilled.
Yeah, and I don't find that surprising in any way. I mean, you have all this training, all these experiences working at all these great fine dining restaurants. I wouldn't expect it to be like necessarily grandma's version of a mole or another dish, right? I mean, you can get that at other restaurants. If I'm coming to Maya Well, I'm coming for your perspective, your take on these dishes.
I agree with you. And I can give you examples in Houston. You know, Mole Negro, if you go to Sochi, and you mentioned Chef Hugo before, I met him a couple of times, him and Tracy and Sophia, his daughter. I've met him briefly. And I mean, they do a great interpretation of mole, which is more traditional, right? Picos has also a great mole. This is just like my interpretation of mole. So I think having an open mind of going to a place that will give you a personal version or a personal vision or interpretation of a dish is what matters the most, because when you go to Maya Well, that's what you're going to get. It's, I think, a high, I was going to say high end, but it's not high end. It's high quality interpretation of some dishes that I love, that I like, that I grew up with, and that I understand from a different perspective now that I have been in the industry for such a long time.
Right. And let me just ask you one other thing, because obviously you still have the businesses in Mexico. How are you dividing your time between Houston and Mexico?
After running, you know, that business, Tu Chocolat, for almost 20 years, I created a very well-oiled machine. So we have two people that run the business. One of them, his name is Rodrigo Romo. He is my right-hand man in Mexico City. He's been with me for, he was the second person that we hired in that company. And he's still with us from that day. And then my wife, Carolina, she travels to Mexico regularly. Actually, right now she is in Mexico for a week, you know, doing her routine monthly visits. And I do go back. Like, I was there like 2 weeks ago, maybe.
But I mean, for the most part, you're here then, it sounds like.
I'm here. Yeah. Yeah. Of course.
And then, as you mentioned, you have this Michelin star pedigree. You have projects you've worked on that have Michelin aspirations. Is that the goal for Maya Well? Is either a Bib Gourmand or a star? I mean, obviously you're too new for the 2025 guide, but you know, looking to 2026, you'll be more established. Is that your aspiration?
I'm gonna say this. Like, if you get a recognition, you know, like I did, you know, previously with 50 Best, if I get a recognition for whatever, it will not be my decision. It will be a reflection of my work. If it happens, you know, that's great. If it doesn't, it doesn't matter. Like, you know, I'm here for the day-to-day pleasure that gives me running a restaurant like this, and, you know, working with great people, like, you know, the Culinary Concepts people, Omar Khan, like all this amazing people that I work with, you know, every single day. That's what I'm here for. Like, I really enjoy what I do. Every time that I wake up, I'm like, okay, let's go to work. I think I'm a great, you know, teacher. I'm a great, I'm not saying mentor, but yeah, that's the only word that I can think of. I like to mentor. I like to share. I like to teach. So that's something that's on my mind all the time. So if that earns me, you know, whatever, that's great. If not, it's okay too.
And then just in terms of your future plans in Houston, I can't imagine you're only going to have one restaurant. Do you want to bring the chocolate shop to Houston? Do you want to retry the casual taqueria in a different location? I mean, what are your, in the next like 3 to 5 years, like what are your goals for your presence in the city?
I think the taqueria is a concept that should be like revisited and explored, because I think it's a concept that people would love. That's just my two cents, right? Like, I don't have a crystal ball to tell you that's going to happen, but I would.
Right. I'm not saying you're like out shopping for leases or anything like that. But I also miss it and thought that it deserved better treatment than it got, both from the public and from its structurally. I'd like to see it come back.
Yeah, me too. And I love it. And, you know, that's something that's always on the back of my mind, thinking about that place, because I think it was good. And then the chocolate shop, even though that would be the easiest to do and to execute, just the weather, man, in Houston, it's hard. So let me tell you this. Cocoa butter melts at 34.5 degrees Celsius, which is like, what, like 93, 94 Fahrenheit. So when you have a product that melts at room temperature, it's not really good to.
Yeah, hard to execute. It's hard to work with.
Yeah, it's difficult. So that's something that's being I can share that with you. That's something that's being actively evaluated.
Okay. Well, I have to say that does bring me to the end of my questions. Is there anything I haven't asked you about that you would like to discuss?
No, I think the only thing, and I mentioned it before two or three times. But just the partnership with Culinary Concepts, man, they have all these amazing people. I mean, you have no idea how easy it was for us to, I mean, not easy, I'm not going to say easy, but it felt like things were flowing. You you know, from the very beginning when we took over that location at Autry Park, and then going through that, you know, design period, like those first few months of design of the restaurant, and then building it, hiring the staff, training the staff, and then doing all the pre-opening stuff that we did, which involved planning, designing, construction, and then training, marketing. Omar has a team that can execute all those five things. And all of them, they're just great professionals. So it was a pleasure for me opening this restaurant. Honestly, it was a real pleasure.
Well, and I, you know, I've been, I think they've been kind of up and coming, or maybe even flying a little under the radar, but in the past 2-3 years, reopened the River Oaks Theater, right? Renovated, beautiful. Everybody loves it. Leo's opened one Best New Restaurant in the Tastemaker Awards. Just announced that they're bringing Liberty Kitchen to Rice Village. Just announced that they're bringing the Audrey to the Galleria area, and opened My Whale with you. So certainly an up and coming hospitality group in Houston. And I'm not surprised to hear that about them, but I do think that that's good, because obviously, you know, I want everybody to be successful, and knowing that you've got that kind of support for this new restaurant is encouraging, because I, you know, it does feel like it's been a little bit of a struggle to kind of get to figure out what works in Autry Park, but having that kind of support is a good first step, I think.
Yeah, I have to say something, that I think Autry Park feels a little different now that Maya Well opened. I mean, we're seeing people visit Autry Park. I've seen people treat Autry Park as their destination. I know Rebis is working extremely hard to help make Autry Park one of the top destinations in the city of Houston. And I'm just super happy to be a part of it.
All right. Well, that seems like a good place to wrap this up. Before I let you go, we have to play the lightning round. 5 easy questions, 5 short answers. Mm-hmm. Just say the first thing that comes to mind.
Okay.
Luis Robledo, what is your favorite ingredient?
Favorite ingredient? Oh my God. Eggs.
What is the first band you ever saw in concert?
First band I ever saw in concert. It was not a band. It was an artist, and it was Rod Stewart back in 1987 in Mexico, in Querétaro, Mexico.
What is your fast food guilty pleasure? It has to come from a restaurant with a drive-thru.
Fast food guilty pleasure. Oh my God. I'm gonna get killed for this, but I'm a health conscious guy. I never go to fat food.
No, that's fair. I strike out on this question like every like 8 or 9 interviews where someone's just like, I don't eat fast food. Fair enough. It's fine. Yeah. Who is your favorite athlete of all time?
Favorite athlete of all time? Oh, it has to be Michael Jordan, man. I grew up in the 90s.
And then finally, what is the new Houston restaurant you haven't been to yet but are dying to try?
I've been trying to go to Credence for a while. I have still to go to Tatemo, which I think is an amazing place. Earns a lot of recognitions, and I haven't been able to go. Yeah, I guess those two.
Yeah, you gotta get to Tatemo. What Emmanuel's doing is so special. And Credence is very good too.
Yeah.
All right. Well, give us the website and the social media for Maya Whale.
It's all Maya Well, M-A-Y-H-U.
M-A-Y-A-H-U-E-L.
H-T-X. That's for all the social media. And website too. MayaWellHTX.com, MayaWellHTX on Instagram.
Luis, thank you so much.
Eric, thank you. Always a pleasure, and hope to see you soon, man.
Absolutely. You can follow me on Instagram at Eric Sandler. Keep it locked on culturemap.com for all the latest Houston bar and restaurant news. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back next week.